Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, July 27, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Clapper versus Amnesty International. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're pleased to welcome Professor Stephen Vladeck and Ben Powell as our experts for today's discussion. We'll begin with opening remarks from Mr. Powell, then Professor Vladeck, then perhaps a little back and forth, and then we'll take questions from the audience. Benjamin Powell is a partner at WilmerHale Law Firm, where he's a member of the Defense, National Security, and Government Contracts and Public Policy and Strategy Practice Groups. Most recently, he was General Counsel of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. He's previously served as Special Assistant to the President and Associate White House Counsel, where his responsibilities included numerous litigation and investigatory matters and policy and legal work with the Department of Homeland Security, Department of State, Department of Commerce, and the Department of Justice. Professor Stephen Vladeck is at American University Washington College of Law, where his work focuses on federal jurisdiction, constitutional law, national security law, and international criminal law. He's a nationally recognized expert on the role of federal courts in the war on terrorism and has co-authored amicus briefs in a host of lawsuits challenging the U.S. government surveillance and detention of terrorism suspects. With that, Mr. Powell, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean, and this is Ben Powell. We're here today to discuss Clapper v. Amnesty International, an important case that the Supreme Court is going to hear on October 29th of this year, presenting an important issue of standing in the national security context. This is a rare type of case that the Supreme Court addresses national security surveillance statutes of this type, and the question of who will have standing to challenge such statutes will be an important case for the court to further define their standing doctrine. I thought it would be helpful to begin with a background on electronic surveillance and the intelligence community and the authorities that exist out there. There are three basic authorities that have existed in the intelligence community to do electronic surveillance to collect foreign intelligence. First, an executive order that goes by the name of 12333, that's 12333. That is essentially the touchstone executive order for the intelligence community. It was originally signed by President Reagan in 1981 and has really had only a few major amendments since then. Perhaps the most transformative one is being in 2008, really reflecting changes to the organization of the intelligence community. But for our purposes here, 12333 is really the executive order where the president has directed the intelligence community to undertake activities to collect foreign intelligence, particularly activities outside the United States targeting foreigners. The second authority you're familiar with is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and that provides a method by which the intelligence community collects foreign intelligence, and in that case, under that statute, they can do that if they receive a court order. They can operate domestically and target U.S. persons in the collection of foreign intelligence. Finally, there was a new authority that everyone learned about during the Bush administration, and that had to do with something called the Terrorist Surveillance Program, carried out by the National Security Agency, and that was a program that was directly authorized by President Bush and caused a substantial amount of controversy. Going back to FISA, though, in 1978, when FISA was passed, they presented a complicated definition of electronic surveillance. But basically, when you were doing an electronic surveillance to collect foreign intelligence information, there were essentially three types of questions you would ask. Who was the target of the activity? Was it a U.S. person or a non-U.S. person? How were you doing the surveillance activity, and where were you doing the surveillance activity? Of particular importance to the 1978 Act is the fact that they exempted from FISA and the court order requirement what they called international signals intelligence activities conducted by the National Security Agency and other electronic intelligence done outside the United States. To put it another way, as Senator Kennedy said in 1978, targeted sweeps aimed at U.S. persons were covered, but non-targeted sweeps by the National Security Agency were not covered, even if they incidentally included U.S. persons. So with that background, what is its relevance to where we are today? Well, fast forward to the FISA debate that we had a few years ago that resulted in the FISA Amendments Act of 2008 that's challenged in this case. That act came about because of changes to the communications grid and the way the world changed in its communications methods. In 1978, much of the international communications were covered via radio and satellite. As the world changed and cabling and wire and fiber optics replaced international satellite communications, what you found was that many activities that were accomplished by the intelligence community outside of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act were getting included in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and it was requiring the intelligence community to go to the FISA court for court orders targeting foreigners, even though I think it's fair to say that under the original passage of FISA, such activities were not intended to come within FISA. So where are we today under the FISA Amendments Act of 2008? To sum up shortly, basically if you're targeting a United States person anywhere around the world, you need a court order. If you're targeting a non-U.S. person outside the United States, you do not need a court order. Now, let me pause there and say, you may say, well, wait a second. Don't you sometimes get a U.S. person involved when you're targeting a non-U.S. person? And the answer is yes, that does happen. And the way that is dealt with is through something called minimization procedures to protect the privacy of U.S. persons. That brings us to this case where the plaintiffs have charged that under the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, this authority that has been provided to the government is an expanded authority that causes them injury because they have a reasonable fear that they are going to be that they are not going to be targeted under the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, but in fact their communications will be monitored under the FISA Amendments Act because under what they characterize as an expanded authority, they believe that they are talking to people who are of intelligence interest and their communications may be monitored under the FISA Amendments Act, that will cause them injury and that injury provides them standing for the cases. And I think with that, I'll turn it over right at that point to Professor Vladek to go into the standing aspects of the case.
Great. Thanks, Ben. Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me again. Thanks to Dean and the Federal Society people. I think the question in the lawsuit, Clapper versus Amnesty International, is the constitutionality of the central provision of the FISA Amendments Act of 2008 that Ben described. This is Section 702 of the statute. It's codified at 50 U.S.C. Section 1881A, no parentheses, for those who want to look it up while we're talking. And the basic question that has arisen under the statute is what Ben alluded to already. The statute does one important thing that FISA did not do. Whereas under FISA itself, the government still had to show probable cause to the FISA court that the target of surveillance was a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power, the big change in the FISA Amendments Act is to allow the Director of National Intelligence, together with the Attorney General, to file basically what's called a certification with the FISA court that is not subject to the same kind of probable cause review as FISA orders were before the statute. And the certification basically says, we are engaged in widespread surveillance targeting non-U.S. persons, as Ben says, and we are doing it in a way that minimizes the concern for U.S. persons. And those certifications, as long as they are approved by the FISA court, which reviews them for their procedural accuracy and correctness, those certifications are good for 1 year. And so what the FISA Amendments Act does is it allows the government to conduct some of the same surveillance that had arguably been conducting outside of the frame of FISA prior to the FISA Amendments Act, but now through a certification approved by the FISA court, and the certification presumably theirs, that there are no serious overbreath problems, that there are no serious effects on U.S. persons. Here's the issue. The reason why this lawsuit arose is because a number of civil liberties groups raised concerns that, in fact, there is a great likelihood that even if this kind of surveillance is not targeted at U.S. persons, that it could be used to sweep up massive amounts of communications by U.S. persons that would ordinarily be protected by the Fourth Amendment. And in other words, that the government was basically going to have the authority without a court order to, if not intentionally, at least knowingly, conduct surveillance of U.S. communications, of protected communications, without having to get a warrant and without having to otherwise comply with the Fourth Amendment. That's the allegation in the lawsuit. So these groups brought suit shortly after the FISA Amendments Act was enacted in 2008. The plaintiffs are attorneys and human rights, labor, legal, and media organizations whose work requires international communications with individuals they believe the government will likely monitor under the FISA Amendments Act. So their claim is not that their clients or the folks with whom they like to communicate are having their rights violated. Rather, their claim is that they have Fourth Amendment rights that are violated by the, if not intentional, then at least knowing and likely interception of substantial numbers of their communications with their overseas clients. We can get into this in the Q&A if people would like to know more. The Second Circuit opinion in this case has a much more thorough description of the nature of the claims. Now, the lawsuit was filed in 2008. In 2009, the District Court in Manhattan, the Southern District of New York, dismissed the lawsuit for lack of Article III standing. So without getting to the merits of the plaintiff's constitutional challenge to the FISA Amendments Act, the District Court ruled that their claims were purely speculative, and that they therefore could not satisfy the test the Supreme Court has laid out for standing. Now, just for those who, you know, don't do this every day, Article III standing has three prongs. The first prong is injury in fact, and that means that the plaintiff must actually be or be likely to incur a cognizable injury to them personally. The second prong is causation. The injury must be fairly traceable to the conduct of the defendant and to the basis for the claim. And then the third prong is redressability. The relief the plaintiff is seeking must actually redress their injury. Those are the three prongs. Now, the district court relied largely on the injury in fact prong and basically said, you cannot prove, you the plaintiffs, that your communications have been or will be intercepted, and therefore you have no standing. And that was basically the reasoning. On appeal, a unanimous panel of the Second Circuit reversed in 2011. Judge Lynch, writing for the panel, explained that in this case, the requirement is not that the plaintiffs show that their communications will be intercepted, but rather that there is a reasonable likelihood that that will happen and that they have taken alternative steps to avoid that taking place. In other words, that the plaintiffs, because of a reasonable belief that their communications will be intercepted by government surveillance powers, have done something to get around that. And in fact, in this case, the plaintiffs explained that they had made alternative steps to communicate with their clients, including snail mail, including flying overseas to meet with their clients in person, sending things through FedEx, and that all of these things cost money. And so, in fact, the plaintiffs were suffering a pecuniary injury to the extent that they were taking cost-incurring steps to avoid the likelihood, in their view, that their communications would be intercepted. The Second Circuit said that is sufficient, at least at the summary judgment stage, based on what's in the record, based on what the government has not disputed, to allow the plaintiffs to at least proceed and to go to the merits of their claim, namely the constitutionality of Section 702. The government sought rehearing en banc in the Second Circuit, and the Court of Appeals split 6-6 on the question of whether rehearing should be granted. As I think all of you know, when the Court of Appeals splits like that, the original panel opinion remains intact. The government filed for certiorari purely on the standing question. The Supreme Court granted cert, and as Ben said, they'll hear argument on October 29th. So with all that said, let me offer a couple of brief reflections that hopefully will sort of provide a nice segue back to Ben and then to our Q&A. The first reflection, I think it's important to note, there is no way that the Supreme Court, when it hears the case in October, will reach anything about the merits of the plaintiff's constitutional challenge. They granted on standing. There has been no discussion in the lower courts of whether the plaintiff's claims would be successful. Indeed, in holding that the plaintiffs have Article III standing, Judge Lynch, writing for the Second Circuit, expressed some concern that the plaintiffs had an uphill battle to actually make out a claim for relief on the merits, but he stressed that those were two different questions. So the first big observation, you know, nothing I think the Supreme Court does this coming term is really going to answer the merits question here, namely whether there is a Fourth Amendment concern with the government surveillance powers under the FISA Amendments Act. A second big picture point, it's, I think, relevant, however, whether the plaintiffs are actually on solid footing in their concerns about how widely the government's powers might sweep. So in other words, even though the Supreme Court is not going to reach the merits of the constitutionality of the FISA Amendments Act, whether the plaintiffs' beliefs are reasonable, that their communications with their overseas clients are likely to be intercepted under surveillance authorized by the FISA Amendments Act, actually may well go to the heart of the standing question. And so, you know, the government's position, I think, is going to be very interesting. And in that regard, it's noteworthy that the government filed their opening brief on the merits yesterday. I think folks should definitely check that out. Third and last point, with regard to the reasonableness of the plaintiff's belief that their communications will be intercepted, that U.S. persons' communications are often intercepted under the FISA Amendments Act, I think it's important to note something that took place last week. Last Friday, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence allowed Senator Wyden to declassify statements he had made about the government surveillance program under the FISA Amendments Act. And one of the critical things that Senator Wyden had sought to declassify was the statement that even under the FISA Amendments Act, and even before the FISA court, which is not exactly the most hostile court in the country to the government's interest in these cases, the government had already had at least one noteworthy case where the FISA court had held that the surveillance under the statute violated the Fourth Amendment, and the minimization procedures were insufficient to protect the interests of U.S. citizens. Now, I think that cuts both ways. In one sense, that shows that the FISA court is not just a rubber stamp and is, in fact, perhaps conducting meaningful review of the government certifications under the FISA Amendments Act. But on the flip side, I think it also shows that there is cause for concern here, and that although we can't know publicly just what kind of surveillance the government conducts under Section 702, we do know at least that there is one case well known within the intelligence community where the government went too far and where U.S. persons' communications were, in fact, intercepted in a manner inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment. And the existence of that one case may go a long way at the end of the day to convincing at least the middle of the Supreme Court that the plaintiffs are not unreasonable in worrying that their communications might be intercepted as well. So why don't I stop there and I'll throw it back to Ben so he can correct my terrible misstatements about the FISA Amendments Act.
No. Thanks for presenting that background. I would just note a few additional points. First, the FISA Amendments Act has, in fact, at least in part, I would say, been challenged in the guise of the Protect America Act, which was a temporary precursor to the FISA Amendments Act, and bears a lot of similarity for the points that we're discussing here in terms of on the merits of allowing the government to get the type of approval that Professor Vodick outlined in targeting foreigners reasonably believed to be outside the United States. And that decision was published in 2008. It's only the second published opinion by the United States Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review. That's the court that hears appeals from the FISA court. It's called In Re Directives pursuant to Section 105B of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And in that case, they found that the Protect America Act did comply with the Fourth Amendment. And much of what they examined there, I think, on the merits has considerable overlap for the FISA Amendments Act. And in fact, if you were to compare the two, the Protect America Act has less protections, less procedures, and less oversight, I think people would generally agree, than the FISA Amendments Act of 2008 that's currently in effect. So you do see challenges to these statutes are possible when a plaintiff has actual standing. Finally, Professor Bladick mentioned the Senator Biden letter. I agree with him. I think that does cut both ways. To the extent that a court is concerned that if somebody does not have standing, that somehow this is going to be left unregulated or left to the FISA court, that certainly shows that you have a very active court that is certainly taking its responsibilities seriously and has found a case where the Fourth Amendment was violated. I would note, though, that much of this activity, to the extent we're talking about foreign intelligence collection, as I mentioned in my opening, occurs under Executive Order 12333, which has no court involvement, does not have the congressional oversight that in any way approaches what is in the FISA Amendments Act. So it's going to be ironic to see how this string fully plays itself out, especially if something were to happen to the FISA Amendments Act. We could end up in a world of much more unregulated surveillance, depending on how things were to develop. So it's kind of ironic that by an administration going to the Congress, having a statute passed by overwhelming bipartisan support that includes more oversight than virtually any other intelligence program one can think of, and involves Article III courts, that somehow has now suddenly provided standing to the plaintiffs. With that, I'll stop and we can take your questions.
Okay. This is Dean Reuter, and I do want to get to the questions from the audience.
Dean, this is Steve. Before we get to that, can I just add one word in response to Ben's interjection?
Go right ahead, Steve.
Thanks. So I just want to say I think Ben has it exactly right, and so hopefully we'll find something to disagree about between now and 2 o'clock. But the only thing I would add is Ben mentioned the FISA Court of Review decision in the In Re Directives case from 2008, and I agree that's a very important precedent. But, you know, an important thing to know about the FISA Court of Review is those are not adversarial proceedings. And so, in fact, you know, there's no opportunity for a plaintiff who feels aggrieved by the FISA Amendments Act to actually bring an action before the FISA court. That's part of why this is a very big deal. The other thing that's relevant to that decision, part of why the FISA Court of Review in 2008 held that the Protect America Act was consistent with the Fourth Amendment is because the FISA Court of Review recognized something called a foreign intelligence surveillance exception to the warrant clause of the Fourth Amendment. In other words, the FISA Court of Review did not say that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to surveillance conducted under the Protect America Act. It said that the government need not obtain a warrant because there is a general categorical foreign intelligence surveillance exception when the government is actually engaged in foreign intelligence surveillance. I think reasonable people can disagree about whether such an exception should exist. I think the relevant point for present purposes is that is the only appellate level court that has to date recognized such an exception. And so if, for example, the Second Circuit were inclined to disagree and does not believe that there is a foreign intelligence surveillance exception to the warrant clause, that would suggest that there actually might be substantial Fourth Amendment problems with the surveillance authorized by the FISA Amendments Act, and indeed, with the surveillance conducted purely by executive order to which Ben alluded, at least insofar as the communications of U.S. persons are knowingly picked up through such surveillance. So that's part of the stakes here.
Let me ask you a question, Steve. This is Dean Reuter. You say that no other appellate court have recognized that. Have any appellate courts gone the other way? Or are they just silent on the issue so far?
Ben can correct me if I'm wrong. I think they're silent on the question. I don't think there are courts that have said there is never, ever, ever a foreign intelligence surveillance exception. But, you know, we all have to remember, right, there are two prongs to Fourth Amendment analysis. There's whether you have to have a warrant in satisfaction of the warrant clause. And even if you don't, there's still the reasonableness piece as well. You know, presumably we don't know why the FISA court rejected the certification that Senator Wyden's letter referred to, but because the FISA Court of Review had recognized a foreign intelligence surveillance exception, we have to assume that that holding was based on the conclusion that the surveillance was in any event still unreasonable. So, you know, I don't want to suggest that this is all about the existence of a foreign intelligence surveillance exception, but just that there's a lot of, you know, unsettled law lurking behind the standing question in this case.
Right. Ben, did you want to respond to that?
I would just note that the decision and the proceedings in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review were adversarial, as Chief Judge Selya likes to use large words, as he put it. Following amplitudinous briefing, the FISC handed down a meticulous opinion validating directives and granting the motion to compel. The petitioner moved the court for a stay pending appeal. They heard oral argument on it and had briefing. In that case, the petitioner had challenged the directives and began compliance under threat of civil contempt. So reading that opinion, it was definitely an adversarial proceeding.
Okay. Let's go to our first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. We seem to have a special issue here with redressability. What is the plaintiff seeking as a remedy? Is it money damages to cover their costs of avoidance? Is it injunction? Or is it immunity from criminal prosecution for any evidence that might be obtained in the way that through the surveillance? And are we perhaps not needing to address the whole issue of a reasonable expectation of privacy and simply abandon it for all electronic communications that are not strongly encrypted? I know I personally encrypt strongly everything of any importance, and I just do that as a matter of course. And things that are really important don't go on any computer at all. So these are reasonable precautions that anyone needs to be prepared to be able to make in today's world.
Who wants to respond to that?
I mean, this is Steve. I can speak to at least to the what the plaintiffs are seeking, and then maybe Ben can speak to the privacy piece of it. You know, the lawsuit is seeking injunctive and declaratory relief, no damages. Indeed, I think, you know, it would be actually difficult to bring an action for damages since they were challenging the statute almost as soon as it went into effect. You know, I think when seeking injunctive relief, obviously the question is, can they show that the continuing use of the statute by the government is unconstitutional? I'll just say one thing about the expectation of privacy before tossing it over to Ben. You know, I think it's certainly true that many people have the technological capability and wherewithal to encrypt their communications. But first of all, not everyone does, and not everyone has the money to do that. And second, even if they did, you know, I don't think we're at a point yet where the Fourth Amendment, you know, doesn't protect our ability to communicate in any situation where the government can actually use technology to see our communications. You know, the whole point of the plain view doctrine is that we're at our own peril when we put things out for all the world to see. When you need sophisticated, you know, hacking software to see it, I think that's not quite the same thing.
I would just note that, Ben, on the redressability point, that is extensively discussed and debated in the Second Circuit opinion as to what they are claiming with this injury is that they've had to take these actions because of this objective likelihood that their communications may be monitored. As the dissent points out, though, and as I talked about with these other surveillance authorities, to the extent, for example, the lawyers in this case feel that they have an ethical duty to communicate in different manners, whether that's in person or via snail mail, it's extraordinarily unclear that if they were to win on the merits, that it would actually redress their harm. As the dissents, numerous of the dissents point out, there are other authorities to acquire the communications outside the United States, and as I mentioned, under Executive Order 12333. And in addition, the dissent points out that the countries that they may be talking to where their clients are, perhaps if you're going to talk about, let's, you know, as Judge Lynch says, we're going to operate in the real world and we're able to kind of look at what may be happening out there, they point out any number of countries that they believe may have extensive monitoring programs. So even if the plaintiffs were to fully win on this case, if it were to go forward, I think there's considerable question about how they're going to comply with the ethics opinion they solicited from Professor Gillers about their ethical obligations where they believe they may be monitored. So even if they did not have the FISA Amendments Act, I think many of those concerns would still be present. So I think there's a huge redressability issue here. I think your question about the reasonable expectation of privacy is directly on point. We are very much struggling with that issue in terms of electronic communications and what is our reasonable expectation of privacy, both in the commercial world and with government surveillance. And you see that even coming up right now with the cybersecurity bill that the Senate's currently considering.
Kind of said, this is Steve again, just on the redressability point. I mean, I guess the question is, if the plaintiffs in this lawsuit are correct on the merits that the knowing and, you know, sort of eminently predictable interception of substantial volumes of communications between U.S. persons and individuals overseas triggers the requirements of the Fourth Amendment for a warrant and or reasonableness, I'm not sure why the same wouldn't be true for surveillance conducted pursuant to other authorities. So, you know, Ben may be right that the government might still rely on other powers to conduct the same surveillance. You know, if in fact the Fourth Amendment protects the communications here at issue, I'm not sure why it wouldn't also protect those communications as well. You know, the idea that a lawsuit would only redress part of the problem and not all of it doesn't make it not redressable. But, you know, that may just be part of the merits question going forward.
Ben Powell, do you want to respond to that?
Professor Vladek makes a very important point. And his point is exactly another reason why we have to, why I think the court's going to think very carefully about standing here. The challenge that he just postulated essentially would eliminate the foreign intelligence surveillance collection efforts of the United States. I don't know if it could not be done under the FISA Amendments Act inside the United States. What Steve is postulating then is a scenario under which essentially the basis since 1978 and frankly going back to World War II of protecting Americans' privacy via minimization procedures and other things of that type were to fall and be declared against the Fourth Amendment, you would essentially shut down a large part of our foreign intelligence collection effort. To put it in more real terms, I know these are a lot of insider terms in terms of minimization and things. What we're talking about is very much like the Wiretap Act. So if you are up on a mafia crime boss, the FBI has a warrant to listen and tap those communications. There are put in place minimization procedures under Title III that basically say you do not, you know, listen to or process the communications of the, you know, crime bosses talk to their dentists, they talk to their dry cleaners and other things that have nothing to do with, you know, related to a crime or planning for a crime. So you minimize those communications. The same concept is done in the intelligence community, perhaps not exactly the same way as it's done in Title III, but you still have what are called these minimization procedures to deal with the exact issue of incidentally collected communications. Because when you're targeting the crime boss under a criminal wiretap, you don't know who's going to call. You know, it could be their kid to discuss, you know, their grades at school, and you need minimization procedures to comply with the reasonableness prong of the Fourth Amendment. If we were to lose that ability in terms of minimization for foreign intelligence collection, that would be a severe change to the foreign intelligence apparatus of the United States. I think it would present a direct showdown between the president and the courts, the likes of which we've probably never seen.
This is Steve. I think Ben is right if that is where this is going, but I don't think that's actually what the plaintiffs are saying. The plaintiffs are not saying that Section 7, that the government has no authority to conduct foreign intelligence surveillance. I think the heart of their claim is that the FISA Amendments Act increases the likelihood intercepting communications that were not targeted and of giving the government the power to use those communications in subsequent proceedings far beyond what would ever have been true under Title III or even FISA itself. I mean, let's remember, under both Title III and FISA itself, there is an antecedent court order based on a showing of probable cause to a neutral magistrate. That's not true under the FISA Amendments Act. And so that puts that much more pressure on the minimization procedures and on the very real concern that the government needs to actually be very, very careful in this context, especially because we're also talking about a substantially larger amount of data. This is not a wiretap on your, you know, on the mobster's phone with his dentist. This is intercepting all emails that go through a particular node. And so I think, you know, that's why, you know, it's easy to paint this case as being about absolutes, but the real problem is actually in the middle. The real problem is the government really doing enough to ensure that it isn't intercepting more communications than that which it needs for foreign intelligence surveillance? You know, and the Wyden letter suggests that that's already been shown to be not true in at least one case. I don't think it would provoke a huge showdown for the courts to say, yes, that's a real concern, and yes, it triggers the Fourth Amendment. It might just require more judicial involvement on the front end, as is true under Title III and FISA, and it might require a more robust set of minimization requirements. So, you know, I agree with Ben about the sort of the nightmare scenario. I just don't think this case is it.
Okay, and with that, let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Eugene Kontorovich. Thanks for the informative discussion. I'm actually principally interested in the standing aspect rather than the national security aspect. And to get a handle on that, can you tell me how many plaintiffs are there? How many such warrants are issued? What's the potential pool of people who would fit into this class that they describe, that they give them some nexus? What percentage of that group are they? Is there any way to get some kind of actual real numbers on what proportion of the universe of affected people there?
Hey, Eugene, this is Steve. I'll go first, and then because I think Ben can probably speak more from experience, and I'll just speak from what's in the pleadings. So there are, I think, about a dozen plaintiffs, some of which are organizational, some of which are individual. And so far as, you know, orders, I mean, this is a point I think needs to be made. There are no individual surveillance orders under the FISA Amendments Act. There are certifications that are program-wide that are made on a yearly basis. And with regard to the actual data of how many communications are intercepted under those certifications, how many of those communications are subject to minimization procedures because they involve U.S. persons, you know, Ben can correct me if I'm wrong, but the government's position, I think, has been first, most of that information is classified. Second, it would actually require a substantial amount of work on their part to obtain it. And third, it might compromise the privacy interests of the individuals who have been surveilled through that authority to disclose that information publicly. You know, I at least think there's a little bit of tension between those competing arguments, but, you know, part of the point of this lawsuit, I think, is to get more data on just how often this happens, how many protected communications are, in fact, intercepted pursuant to the FISA Amendments Act, and so on. And so I think that's, you know, part of what this lawsuit is about is how little we know with regard to the answers to those questions.
This is Ben. As to the number of plaintiffs in terms of who would fit into the class, as Steve pointed out, it's a number of NGOs, criminal defense attorneys, and various other groups, including the Service Employees International Unit, the International Criminal Defense Attorneys Association, The Nation Magazine, Pan American Center, and Amnesty International and the Global Fund for Women. I think if you were to expand that group beyond just the named plaintiffs here, obviously you'd have a fairly large universe of people who may claim that we work internationally with people who may be, for one reason or another, of interest to the U.S. government for foreign intelligence collection efforts. So you could potentially have a very large class of people who would be similarly situated, I think, to these plaintiffs and what their, at least, claims would be. I don't know of any statistics that have been publicly released in terms of how many of the, quote, certifications there have been actually approved by the FISA court. But as Steve noted, these are not individual orders. In fact, the FISA Amendments Act 2008 was passed in part to remedy the problem that individual orders were increasingly being required to target foreigners who were located overseas.
Let me ask a question of each one of our experts. For Ben Powell, there's been a suggestion in some cases before, not, and I don't think necessarily in the national security area, that the administration hasn't provided a robust defense of a federal statute. I'm wondering if there are any grumblings about that in this case. And then a question for Steve Vladeck, Professor Vladeck, does your line of reasoning at all depend on kind of the notion that the FISA court itself has been co-opted, that it's, you know, if not part of the intelligence community, you know, too readily sees their side and not necessarily the side of those people that might be subjected to searches?
So this is Ben. On the question of the robust defense and whether the administration in this case has provided a robust defense, I've not heard any grumbling that they have not provided the kind of the full defense of the statute. I think a couple of data points on that are important. First, you have the unusual case of a petition for certiorari not just signed by the Solicitor General of the United States, which would not be unusual, but also signed by the General Counsel for the Director of National Intelligence and the Acting General Counsel for the National Security Agency. They talk in their petition about the overwhelming importance of this case and how critical this program is to the United States. The reauthorization, the program is, the FISA Amendments Act was passed with a sunset, and that sunset comes due here at the end of this year. The administration itself has publicly stated that this is the most important legislative priority for the intelligence community. So I think the administration is very concerned about this case in terms of wanting to make sure that it's handled at the highest level and is given every possible defense, given the importance of this program to the administration.
Okay. Professor Vladek?
Sure, Dean. So, you know, this actually may be where I differ from some of my sort of, you know, colleagues to my left. I think there's been a lot of criticism targeted toward the FISA court over the years for its, at times, you know, rubber stampish quality of virtually always signing off on government applications. I don't think that's the problem that's animating the FISA Amendments Act challenge. I think, you know, one of the solutions to my mind that would at least mitigate the Fourth Amendment concerns would actually be for Congress to increase the role that the FISA court plays in reviewing certifications. You know, as Ben notes, the certification review happens, you know, at most annually, and it's not the same kind of probable cause finding that the FISA court conducted prior to 2008. If folks want to look at the relevant statutory language, it's 50 U.S.C. 1881A, parentheses I, parentheses 2B. And what that provision says is all the FISA court reviews when it's reviewing a certification is whether the certification is procedurally correct and whether the targeting procedures are designed to, one, ensure that an acquisition authorized under the statute is limited to targeting persons reasonably believed to be located outside the United States, and two, prevent the intentional acquisition of any communication as to which the sender and all intended recipients are known at the time of the acquisition to be located in the United States. So in other words, you know, the FISA court is not reviewing for substantial overbreadth. The FISA court is just reviewing for intent. And I think, you know, Ben knows better than I do and probably better than anyone on this call how important these kinds of surveillance authorities are to the United States. The point is not to dispute the power of the government to conduct the surveillance. The point is to raise the very real concern that without more rigorous oversight by somebody, be it the FISA court ex ante or Congress or the public ex post, you know, there's nothing in the statute itself that really prevents substantial overbreath from taking place when it comes to interception of protected communication. So that's part of why this case is hard, because I think most people sympathize with the government's need to be able to conduct foreign intelligence surveillance. You know, I certainly think very much of that surveillance is not bounded by the Constitution insofar as it involves non-U.S. citizens overseas. But, you know, the technology makes it increasingly likely that the means through which the government intercepts those communications will also intercept some of our communications. And I think, you know, even if we're comfortable with some of our own communications being intercepted, there's a point where the Fourth Amendment has something to say. So, Dean, I mean, it's a long-winded answer to your question. I think the concern here has nothing to do with the FISA court being a rubber stamp, quite to the contrary. You know, I, for one, would be much, you know, less concerned with the FISA Amendments Act if it included a more vigorous role for the FISA court to play.
And this has been on the FISA court myth of a rubber stamp. I think we're in agreement on this. I will label it a myth. A couple of factual data points. The first published decision ever of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review was in 2002, addressing minimization procedures. This was post-September 11th. And that decision details, in fact, a number of places where the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court had been perhaps far too aggressive in imposing a number of requirements that were not required by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act nor the Fourth Amendment. And you can also read the joint investigations of the Congress into the attacks of September 11th. And they go into great detail about worries about approaching the FISA court and perhaps the court going beyond what the statute required to put in requirements that were not required by the statute or the Fourth Amendment, and how that frankly impacted our ability to detect plots against the United States. So there are a number of factual data points out there that show over time the FISA court has been very rigorous in doing their job.
Very good. We've got another question from the audience, so let's turn to that.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's examine just how the Fourth Amendment is involved here. Part of the protection of the Fourth Amendment is not just that a warrant receives the attention of a hopefully unbiased or disinterested judge, but that it also involves an element of notice to the target and an opportunity to challenge the warrant. So what we are lacking here is the lack that we get with an ex parte proceeding where there is not even a possibility of an adversarial challenge. So if we are not going to give notice to the target, and I think that's an area we really need to examine as a country, then there at least needs to be appointed a lawyer to represent him, even if he is not in contact with that lawyer, who can play, as it were, devil's advocate and make it an adversarial proceeding. What do you think about that?
Who wants to take that question?
This is Ben. Couple of points on that part. This has been an issue that was thought about in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the issue that you bring up, and it's really a balance between the need to carry out intelligence collection efforts and delayed notice under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Obviously, if you're undertaking activities against an agent of a foreign power, a spy, something of that nature, it's kind of undercuts the purpose of the surveillance to give them notice. And so that presents a certain amount of problems and is always an issue that we have to face in kind of dealing with secret and classified efforts and the tension that presents in an open and transparent society. Second point in terms of this case is here we're not targeting about the targets of the communication or the activity. So it would be a very difficult situation because the problem we face and that the government faces with incidental communications is if you're targeting somebody overseas, you do not know who they're going to communicate with a priori. So while you may know who you're targeting, you don't know who's going to be communicating them and whose information you'd pick up on an incidental basis. So again, like in the Title III case, you don't know who that crime boss is necessarily going to communicate with.
This is Steve. I mean, I think Ben has it exactly right on so far as the balance struck by FISA. I think the question that John raises, I think, is a good one, which is whether there's a way in which the FISA Amendments Act actually changes that balance in a way that merits reconsideration. So, you know, for 30 years, we had a statute that I think represented the best efforts and really sort of nonpartisan efforts to, you know, carefully protect both the government's interest in conducting foreign intelligence surveillance and the, you know, very real Fourth Amendment rights, not just of the targets of foreign intelligence surveillance where they have Fourth Amendment rights, but also of individuals whose communications are intercepted incidentally. You know, I think the problem with the FISA Amendments Act is that as a matter of scale, I think it dramatically could, you know, we don't know whether it actually has, increased the volume of communications involving U.S. persons that the government is able to intercept through its authorities. And I think the question becomes, you know, does there come a point where we've sort of struck the balance too many times in the wrong direction? So, you know, John pointed out the sort of the notice requirement. Well, already in the Title III, you know, context, courts have held that notice can be after the fact, right? And indeed, under FISA, there are at least some procedures for providing notice in extreme cases where it wouldn't interfere with our continuing foreign intelligence surveillance. Same with regard to probable cause, right? Under Title III, the government must show probable cause to believe that a crime has been or is being committed. Under FISA, you just have to show probable cause that the target of surveillance is a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. Again, right, those are compromises. Those are compromises that have been scrutinized by the courts. I think reasonable people can disagree about how the courts have resolved them, but I think, you know, they've basically gotten pretty close. The problem with the FISA Amendments Act, again, is how it changes the calculus. Now you don't have that kind of upfront judicial review sort of standing in for being represented by counsel and having notice. And so you have more concerns that, you know, internal processes within the executive branch will be inadequate to play the same checking function. Again, I don't know what the right answer is. I think the critical point is that the public doesn't know either because there's so little out there publicly about the kind of surveillance the government conducts under the FISA Amendments Act. And just to sort of tie this all together, you know, the government in its merits brief on the summary judgment motion in the district court, so in other words, on the actual Fourth Amendment question, made a whole lot out of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence concerning incidental overhears, right? So Ben's example of the government's wiretapping a mobster, he calls his dentist, you know, they weren't expecting to overhear the dentist, but you can still use that evidence. The problem is that, you know, in that context, the government may not reasonably be anticipating that the dentist is going to call and talk about his Medicare fraud, right? In this context, I think the government can reasonably anticipate that at least some of the means they're using to intercept all these communications will also intercept the communications of protected U.S. persons. And so, you know, the question becomes, how do we restrike the balance in that context that Congress, you know, so carefully tried to strike in 1978? And, you know, I think there's a very good case that the FISA Amendments Act errs a little bit too far on the government side. I don't think, just to clarify what I said before, I don't think the answer is, you know, the government shouldn't have these authorities. I think the answer is a more robust role for the courts, at least, if not for, you know, the targets of the surveillance and they whose communications are incidentally intercepted. So, you know, that's why, I mean, that's more a policy argument than a legal one, and I doubt very much that we're going to see that on Capitol Hill as Congress considers reauthorizing the FISA Amendments Act. But I think that's the stakes of this litigation and why the, you know, these plaintiffs are so invested in getting the courts to reach the merits.
Ben Powell, you want to respond?
Well, I think it's a very interesting debate. And in terms of what is the role of courts in these foreign intelligence collection scenarios and efforts, and frankly, some of this debate is what played out in the Bush administration in the decision to go to Congress and ask for the FISA statute to be changed. Just a bit of history. The problems with the FISA statute that had developed since 1978 and that had something to do with the failure to detect the cells that were operating here in the United States prior to September 11th were not unknown to the government. There are memos that have been released under FOIA. There are declassified parts of various bodies that investigated 9/11 that talk about the problems with the FISA statute as the worldwide communications changed. And it was interesting that even given the knowledge that the government had of the problems, they continued down a path where they were very worried about going to Congress to change the FISA statute because you didn't know what would happen if you open up the statute. You would be attacked for violating Americans' privacy. The debate that happened prior to going to Congress and with a bill that ultimately resulted in the FISA Amendments Act, you know, there were two alternatives. One was to simply return things to the 1978 status quo, which would have been an amendment to FISA that basically said international signals intelligence activities do not fall within FISA. We're returning to 1978. In 1978, it was international satellite and radio communications. Our international communications grid has changed since then. So we're going to fix it to make it technology neutral just to reflect the way the grid has changed. That would have resulted in no judicial involvement, none of the mountain of paper. And it is a true mountain that is given to the Congress and the judiciary. If you were to read the act, you will find endless reports that are given to the intelligence and judiciary committees on the Hill. The FISA court does not just approve things under the act and then disappear. There are all kinds of post hoc reporting requirements that go to them. Multiple inspector general reviews, Department of Justice reviews, DNI reviews. It is, you know, from personal experience, it is an incredible oversight apparatus that, frankly, is about a program that is targeting foreigners overseas. So it's a bit ironic, given all of these oversight resources we're putting on a foreign intelligence targeting program that in no way is replicated, perhaps, for domestic programs that are carried out by agencies here in the United States. So I bring up that debate because it's an interesting debate where Professor Vladek says, you know, perhaps we need more judicial involvement, we need more careful review, we need more scrutiny by courts. If this were to fall, I don't know what the ultimate result would be, but I would not be surprised to see those people who believe that it should basically be returned to the to 1978 and there should be no involvement whatsoever. May come to the fore and say, you know, we tried this once, and it kind of didn't work.
All right. Well, gentlemen, looks like we've exhausted the audience. We've certainly exhausted our budgeted time. I want to thank you both for appearing here today for our audience members. This has been terrific, both for Ben Powell and for Stephen Vladek. Thank you so much for joining us. I also want to thank our audience members for dialing in and invite you to join us next Tuesday at 1 p.m. for our next call, which is on Sackett versus EPA, and again to check with our website for other upcoming calls. But until Tuesday, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.